We've got a lot of people on the call today. This has been quite a turnout just to hear our conversation, David. And I'm looking forward to us talking as much as I am looking forward to everybody asking questions, because I think you are the man that people like to ask questions on these sorts of topics, being, as you were saying, perhaps a little bit more on the outside of the Alexander technique than others, and maybe even being able to have a bit of a perspective looking in or looking back on what the Alexander technique profession is doing. But as I said, we have a lot of people have registered for this call. I've got questions have come in from the email, and what we'll do is those emailed questions we will save until the very end, if we have time, until we've had a chance to hear from everyone who wants to ask live questions. So if you have emailed a question to us and you do want to ask it live, feel free to do that too, because if you do ask it live, we'll cross it off the paper list. Much nicer to get it from you in person than on an email. But as I say, if we have time, we'll get to those other questions towards the end of the call. We only have an hour, and I know it's going to go very fast.
Oh, I booked the next 3 hours. I'm ready to keep going all night.
3 hours. Yeah. I have 2 minutes past the hour on my clock, and whilst people are still signing in, I have to turn off the beeper, because every time somebody signs in, my system beeps at me, so I'm going to turn that off now.
Okay, well, you just fire away on questions whenever you're ready there.
Absolutely. Not a problem. Get rid of this. Okay, welcome everybody to the call. This is Paul Cook. You're listening to a live recording of a conversation between myself and David Gorman today, courtesy of directionjournal.com. And it's a pleasure to have you all here. We have lots and lots of people on the call already, and also joining thick and fast in the background. But we can't wait any longer for those who are running late. It's 3 minutes past the top of the hour, and it's time to get the ball rolling. So let me introduce our guest today. We are speaking with Mr. David Gorman. And you probably have read the invitation email that I sent out about David, but for those of you who have only heard of this call via word of mouth or on the Twitter, courtesy of Franis, or via any other method that we are beaming out to the world at the moment, David Gorman is these days best known for his own work called Learning Methods, which has grown out of 30 years of research and teaching experiences from a grounding in the Alexander technique. He spent many late nights in the mid-70s drawing furiously, and if you have not yet come across his work called The Body Movable, then you must. You must get a copy of it. I think you can still get that through David's website.
Yep.
Now in its fifth edition. Yes, David?
That's right, yeah.
On your website. It's an incredible, incredible encyclopedia of the human body. And I remember the first time we studied it at our training school when I was training to be a teacher. And honestly, the first time I saw it, I thought, how did somebody do all that work? It must have taken a whole lifetime. So it's a wonderful work. Plus, that isn't the only thing, of course. Many other books, e-books, audios, articles, and materials are available from David's website, which is learningmethods.com. So welcome to our call today, David.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul, and hi to everybody out there.
We have a bit of a template that I like to go through, David, to get a starting point on who you are, where you've come from, and then we're going to get into our topic today, which is Alexander technique, looking into the 21st century, now that we are well and truly in it. So how about we have a quick summary of how you came across the Alexander technique, why you pursued it, and from there, who were your most influential teachers, please?
Okay. Well, back in the, very early 70s, I was an artist. I was drawing, largely drawing, some painting, and at one point I decided I wanted to be able to draw people better from, memory is not the right word, but from knowledge about how we were built rather than have to have a model. And so I started to study some anatomy, and I was very lucky. I lived in a small city in Canada where they had a course at the university where you could just pay your fee and go in and do dissection with the cadavers, which was absolutely fascinating. But in the process of going in there, I never went to very many of the lectures, but I would go in the evening and just cut and draw and cut and draw. And it began to be kind of clear to me between the work I was doing there, just the physical understanding of it and visual understanding, and what I was finding in the books, anatomy and physiology books, that a lot of what are sort of good use, what I would call it now, I wasn't thinking of it then, but that kind of poise and centeredness that I was seeing in people that I myself didn't have, had to do a lot with balance, was how I was thinking about it. I didn't really have any particular problems other than maybe my allergies, but physical problems, you know, pain or back problems, but I had a kind of a ongoing sense of just unease. You know, I was never comfortable. I was shifting around and propping my arm up against the chair and then moving this way and that way, like I think as George Coghill said, this unwieldy collection of parts that I was always trying to arrange somehow. It began to be kind of clear to me when I was thinking, well, there's, you see people sometimes that have this beautiful poise or centeredness, and it had something to do with balance, is how I was thinking about it. So I was talking to a friend of mine in Toronto, this was back in the very early 70s, and about all this, and she said, oh, you should go and see so-and-so, he teaches balance, and it was the only Alexander teacher in Canada at the time, a man named Nehemiah Cohen. And I went to see him, and the first session was one of those classic ones of kind of feeling like you're walking on air when you come out. And I thought, I don't know what that guy just did, but whatever it is, that's it. That's the thing that I've been looking for. So I started to have lessons every week, driving from the city where I lived to Toronto for lessons, and had a lot of physical changes. And changes with my breathing and the allergies, and so I got quite excited about the work. But I think the biggest thing, and I guess probably everybody will relate to this one, was that rather surprising change that wasn't just the physical, but how it changed your way of seeing things, your way of thinking, the just beginning to see the connection between the way that we sort of are physically and the whole mental point of view we have out onto the world and about ourselves, and when the sort of profoundness penny drops of, whoa, there's a lot more to this work than I thought. So I kind of immediately wrote off to all the training courses that I knew about, which was simply the three in England at that point, Carrington, MacDonald, and Barlow, and said, I want to train, and they all wrote back in due course and said, sorry, we're all full up, but we'll let you know. I didn't know there was, in fact, two trainings in the States, but I didn't know they existed. So I carried on with my drawing and painting, and it was actually about 2 years later, I'd quite forgotten about the whole thing. I was still having lessons periodically and still a big fan of the work, but I got a letter from Dilys Carrington saying, we have a space for you in 6 months if you're interested. And I wrote back and I said, oh, well, thank you, but sorry, no, I'm doing other things now. I kind of forgot all about that. And then I sent the letter off, and I began to think about it, and I thought, well, you know, it'd be my chance to get to Europe and see all the art galleries. I had some money because I just sold some pictures, and if I don't like it, I can quit and come home. That was kind of the clincher. So I phoned up Dilys the day she got the letter and said, tear it up, I'm coming. And I think it was my good luck that it happened to be Carrington's that I got accepted on, because I had no idea there was any differences in the work at all, since I'd only ever worked with one teacher. But Walter's particular take on things and his kind of acceptance and openness and ability to make everybody feel like they were doing okay was just perfect for me. So that's kind of how I got there. Through my anatomy study. So when I got into it, I had already had quite a bit of knowledge. And one of the first things that really grabbed me, and I think it's been part of my way of looking at it from the beginning, has been, well, here's all these amazing experiences, but just what's going on under the surface when that happens? You know, what can explain such a radical transformation of going into a lesson perhaps full of tension and strain and struggle, and within sometimes minutes being in a very, very different state of being. You know, something quite dramatic is happening physically and physiologically, and of course with the knowledge I had at the time and the curiosity, just had a lot of curiosity, what could possibly be going on that could bring about that big a change, which is... You know, part of what I then explored over the course of the training and writing that book was partly my investigations to kind of make sense out of what it was that was really happening.
Yep. Okay, terrific. That's a wonderful starting point. And then from there you completed your course in the UK and what, came straight back to Canada? Or what did you do there?
No, actually things took a interesting, it was a very good turn for me, was shortly after I got to Carrington's, Don Burton, who was doing the all the anatomy talks there, I started to do a little bit of work with him, because he was absolutely fantastic. I mean, he just knew his stuff backwards and forwards, but he was the world's worst artist. I mean, I knew a fair amount of anatomy, but I would look at the pictures he was drawing, and if I didn't know the anatomy, I would not be able to figure out what he was drawing. So I suggested to him, is, you know, if you do all the talking, I'll do the drawing. And so we sort of did some team teaching. I was horribly shy at that point, and the last thing I ever wanted to do was lead a class, but I was happy to have my back to everybody and draw pictures while Don talked with everybody. So then fairly shortly after we started to do that, he left teaching at Carrington's because he started his own training course. So Walter asked me if I would do the anatomy talks at Carrington's, and I carried on working with Don. So I had a lot of, I was starting to do teaching at those two schools even while I was in the process of training. And then Karen Wentworth, who I had initially just come to stay at her house, but we fell in love and we're together. From about the first year of my training, we started to do workshops with Don and that group in England, and also then Karen and I and Michael Frederick and Lena and Frank Sheldon started up the first set of residential workshops that later became the Claymont workshops and now the Sweetbriar workshops. So lots of chances to work on those during the breaks, so that I had a kind of an atypical beginning in that I'd had a lot of experience teaching and working in groups and in residential things before I even graduated as a teacher.
Oh, wow. Okay. So then that gives us a great starting point, David, to understand where you're coming from. You haven't just appeared in the last week. Sure. And the work that you created with the written work and your illustrations, diagrams, and then your anatomy teaching gave you more and more and more material to explore and learn with. And from that, to cut a long story short, and we have to do that today, unfortunately, is you went on to create what you've now called Learning Methods, learningmethods.com. So in a paragraph, if it's possible, can you tell us what Learning Methods is, because I would love to get on to you know, the topic of our call today, but we must mention what learning methods is to save
people. Well, I think it's relevant because it really kind of evolved from a few, well, probably quite a number of steps, but it was quite, in a sense, a natural outgrowth of just exploring what is this work and what happens for people. And, you know, I wish I'd kept a diary back then to really track exactly how the insights led to this and that and that. But one of the things I definitely remember was a starting point on some of it was back around early 81, shortly after the Body Movable was published. In fact, I sent a copy to Raymond Dart, and I started up a little conversation with him because I was quite intrigued by those articles he'd written that were talking, especially the one about the spiral muscular system that was starting to show larger whole person patterns rather than all these little details. And we got into a bit of a conversation, and it turned out that he was going to be over at the Dolman Del Caro Institute in Philadelphia the summer when we were also doing a set of the Clément workshops. So I arranged to go and see him, we got talking a bit, and it just struck me at one point when he was, because I wanted to ask him all this stuff about anatomy and function, and he looked at me, and he just had a stroke the year before, and he'd been recovering from it, and he just said, you know, David, it's all about the brain. It's the brain that's special about humans. And there was just something, you know, coming from somebody who obviously knew their stuff about the body, pointing that out struck me, and it stayed with me quite a lot, that just the thought, no, it's about the brain and the thinking and the way we... because then over a bit of time, it began... There was a... And here I think it's relevant to our other discussion, so I'll kind of weave that in a little bit now, is I think one of the biggest things that I see happening in the sort of pedagogical framework of the Alexander Technique that I think would probably be a very, very good thing for the work if it changed is the tendency of us to sort of see it as a technique, as a thing, you know, as a thing. I teach the Alexander Technique, and here's the things you will learn. And so we kind of got this thing that we're teaching, and so people come to us, and we're the expert on this thing, and then we want them to learn about the thing and how to do it. And so, in a sense, we're teaching them something new that they weren't doing before, but rather than, in a sense, doing what Alexander did, which there was no Alexander Technique, of course, so he didn't go and teach about a thing, and he didn't go and learn somebody else's thing, though he might have dabbled in other people's things at times. But what he did is he went and looked directly at what was happening, in this case, with himself. And so he just went straight to the source and said, you know, what's actually happening here? Let me look at what's going on right in front of me as it is without any particular framework or thing I'm trying to do. And I think in a lot of ways we'd all benefit from doing that. And I think one of the reasons why I got, why that came along for me was I'd already done that with the anatomical side of it, is to go, now what's going on with the structure here? What's going on with those changes? And then I went back to the kind of the actual structure and went, now what happens and how do muscles work? And eventually out of that came up with my model about a elastic sprung suspension system, which I've written a little bit about, but I'm maybe two-thirds of the way through a whole book on it now that unfortunately is taking a very long time to get finished. But so I've been doing that around the body, but it struck me more and more when I was teaching that, you know, here you have people coming in for lessons, and we have this remarkable ability, of course, when we're trained to put our hands on them and facilitate changes that are quite dramatic quite quickly. And they go out feeling wonderful, but they would come back the next week and often be very much in the same sort of state, or at least a lot of them. And I kept kind of looking at that and going, now what's going on here? Are they not kind of getting it, or is there something not quite working in the work, or am I not quite as good a teacher as I could be? And it remained kind of a bit of an open question as to why people weren't kind of getting it and changing their lives the way that I thought the work should work, the way that it in fact had affected me and a number of other people that I knew. And so I decided to kind of investigate that a bit, and this is when I'd moved back to London prior to starting my own training course, and I went around and asked a lot of the heads of training and other people, you know, of the people that you work with, not so much how many do you think have really, really changed so that they really literally do not have their problems anymore, but of the ones that have really changed that way, can you see any particular difference why they've managed to do it and other people seem to keep getting into the same stuff and keep on having to get free from it and then get into it and get free from it? And you know, the technique is a very good coping mechanism for them. You know, the teachers can liberate them from their tension and maybe they can do it a bit themselves, but they still have the problem. It keeps coming back and they have to keep getting rid of it, as opposed to those people that could say, well, you know, it's just gone. I don't even have that anymore. And like Alexander said at the end of The Use of the Self, and I was free from this problem that had plagued me since birth. And out of all of them and the people that I'd worked with and looking at myself, the main thing that I saw was that it was the people who had kind of taken the experiences that they'd had and not just went, ooh, this is lovely, you know, how do I do this? How do I recreate this? How do I learn this technique so I can make myself feel good or get out of any problems? But they'd taken that experience and really, in a sense, it had shown them something about what they were already doing. And I remember one particular example when it really hit home for me is I was working with somebody he was a businessman, and he just said at one point, he said, you know, I just feel suddenly so present and so just here, as normally I'm just so far ahead of myself, I'm way out ahead doing a million things, and now just suddenly I'm like I'm back here at this moment. And, you know, just the way he said it, and he and I both kind of looked at each other, and he said, you know, that's what I do. I get so far out ahead of myself, and so he went out he went out of that session and he came back the next week and he said, you know, I really understood that. I went in and I stopped getting ahead of myself and I just decided I'm going to go in to work and I'm going to just do what I can do in the time that I can do it and just, that's just what I'm going to do. I'm just going to live in the moment more or less as much as I can and whatever doesn't get done, doesn't get done. And he said, you know, I just haven't had any of the tension problems. It's just not there. It's gone. And yep. it was kind of that realizing that it isn't just about changing the, you know, of course a lot of people are working like this and a lot of people do recognize those kind of changes, but certainly at that point very few people were kind of making that part of their way of teaching. And then there was another thing that happened around the same time that I think was one of the major ones that really turned around my way of looking at it was I had a person I was working with, you know, standing in front of the chair with a mirror on the other side, and I was helping him stand up and sit down, and at one point I said to him, he was a fairly new student, I said, did you know you just pulled your head back when you stood up? And he said, no, I didn't. You know, very, And I said, well, you know, I can show you in the mirror that it happened. He said, oh, I'm quite sure that it happened, but I didn't do it. And,
oh, no.
You know, it really struck me for the first time. Normally, I would have gotten kind of busy saying, yeah, I know, you're not aware that it happened, and it's an unconscious habit, and so on and so forth, and I can show you in the mirror, and you need to become aware of it and inhibit it, and da-da-da-da-da. But it suddenly struck me, you know, he's absolutely right. He didn't do it at all. He didn't even know it was happening any more than Alexander knew it. You know, he was doing that until he looked in the mirror. And yet I would get normally quite busy telling him, showing him and convincing him that he did do it and that he should find a way to undo it. But the thing that really got me was I suddenly realized, you know, right there at that moment, I realized that because I would get busy doing that and get him busy doing it, none of us would actually find out what in fact he was doing when his head did come back. Because that was the big one. I went, okay, now he's absolutely right. He didn't do it, but it did happen. But what was he doing when it happened that perhaps, let's say, other people are not doing or are doing something different when it doesn't happen. And I had to just say, well, I don't really know what people are up to when those things that we as teachers, when we look at them and we see the misuse, you know, what are they actually doing at that moment? Is it just purely a totally unconscious habit and they're just like anybody else? Or are they kind of up to something in a particular way that misuse that we're seeing is the organization of them being up to? And I didn't know, but I'd kind of decided at that moment that I wanted to find out. I was curious, I guess. That's probably the biggest thing that's driven my discoveries, is just the curiosity of, you know, what's going on here. And so I started to work with people and just stop them every time I saw some misuse, and going, well, you know, where are you? What are you up to? What are you thinking? What are you doing? And it was kind of awkward, and a lot of it seemed pretty odd, and, you know, stopping somebody in the middle of standing and asking them. But gradually I got clearer about it, and gradually I began to see the pattern that, for the most part, let's say in simple sitting and standing, people were just literally ahead of themselves. They were already three quarters of the way up to standing before they'd even left the chair. Or conversely, they would say, well, I don't know, I'm just sitting down in the chair. And I'd say, well, what do you mean by that? And they, well, you know, I'm going to the chair. And gradually I began to see I needed to ask them, you know, where their attention was. And it was always out ahead of themselves, you know, almost down to the chair. And I began to see it as the way they were projecting their attention was in fact organizing their system. You know, as it were, got kind of out ahead of themselves, you can almost see the body reach out for that standing, and you get this, you know, the classic thing of the head pull back and the reach and the arms come out. And gradually I began to find ways to not just ask people about what was happening right in front of me, but it dawned on me that it's not so important what's happening in the teaching room when I'm taking them through various movements, but when they would come in and say, you know, I'm so tense now from my day, I go, well, now why are they tense? What have they been up to during the day that's getting them tense? And so I began to ask them, you know, well, what were you up to today? Was there something special? Because they'd say, you know, I'd just been on holiday and I was fine. I had no tension at all, and now I get back to work. And I go, well, that's interesting. You know, what's the difference for you between your holiday and, you know, all sounds kind of obvious, but they would say things you'll recognize, like, well, you know, on the holiday I didn't have to do anything. Now I have all this stuff I have to do, and I have to rush through and get it all done. And it just struck me after, you know, a little bit of this, I began to see the patterns, and I go, could it be that if somebody goes into their workday with that, here's all this stuff I have to do, and that's such a strong imperative that they will try to do it, and of course there isn't time to do it, so they will rush and get out ahead of themselves. If that's what the person is doing, is this state of tension and stress the resulting state of a person doing that? And so it began to change around the way I saw things, that the use of the self was no longer what I was seeing in somebody's body. That was no longer the misuses. I began to see that more as the functioning of someone who was misusing themselves. The actual person was operating on this idea that they had to do all this stuff and were rushing, trying to do it. And as they did that, of course, the tension and the state they got themselves in is the state that people get in when they're trying to do that.
Brilliant.
And
I'm with you.
As I began to see it that way, I thought, well, okay, so why don't we make an experiment, just like the guy I told you about that saw that first. I said, well, what if you go into your work tomorrow and you just do what you can do at the speed you can do it and see what happens? And, of course, over and over they would come back and say, well, you know, I just didn't have those same tensions. And not only that, I was more present.
I got quiet.
You know, I was able to see what I'm doing more. I was able to actually do a much better job, and I didn't end up doing less. I actually ended up doing more. But the interesting part was, that, you know, they didn't have those symptoms. They'd the whole thing had changed without them having to free their neck or do any other physical change. So that was really the kind of start of the
trying to change, sort of change their reactions to something that was stronger than their ability to change their reactions.
Yeah, in effect, it started to see the physical thing that happened, the tension or the strain or the nervousness before performance, was not the problem. That was simply the organization of how they were meeting that moment. And if I spent a bit of time and found out from them how they were seeing it, it became pretty clear why they were having the reactions that they were having. And so I didn't have to get them to free their tension before they performed. They simply wouldn't get tense if they weren't trying to play better than they could play, or try to play perfectly, or, you know, once we could kind of find out from them what they were up to at the times when things worked well versus what they were up to at the times when things didn't work well, it became pretty clear how they're literally the manner of use, that is, the way they went about things, how it organized them in a very good way if they just went into the performance, let's say, being what they could and doing whatever they could and not trying to be any better and staying focused on what they loved about the music and not worrying about what anybody else thought and so on. And as soon as they went into something else, of course, they'd get all caught up in the physical problems. So the upshot of it was, it just gave me a whole new territory to work in that managed to eradicate a lot of these problems very, very quickly, sometimes in one session.
Amazing. Not 20 or 30 lessons.
No, I mean, there still were times and still aspects of people's functioning where they needed to learn much clearer. We can get into that later because I think that's another issue about how we can teach people more clearly how they function in a way that's not so mystical and seductive. As can often happen when we kind of quote-unquote give the experience. But interestingly, at that particular time, I was just thinking that this was the Alexander technique, and I'd simply found a way for it to be more literally true. I mean, it really seemed to me that was the use of the self, not the use of the body. And we really were talking a psychophysical unity as the person went into that kind of way of, let's say, being ahead of themselves. Sure enough, their whole system responded into a kind of organization that went with that. And as soon as they stopped operating that way, bingo, their whole system changed again.
You were evolving your understanding, thinking that, well, this is just the Alexander technique.
Or a clearer way for me to see it. And, you know, I would have been very happy, in fact, at that point, if I had just been able to contribute somewhat to the evolution of the work. Quite frankly, why I ended up calling it different was I happened to be running a training course in London at the time, and I hit a huge backlash from a number of people, in particular people on the council, and it was extremely heavy duty. And I just, at one point, I just went, okay, I don't need this. This is, if they're so insistent that what I'm doing is not the Alexander technique, then, you know, obviously they're doing something very different. This was a lot of people that didn't even bother to come to see what I was doing. And so I just thought, okay, I was finishing my training anyway, and the work was starting to head out in this direction. And I also had another big experiment I wanted to make, because I wasn't sure just how far this way of working would go, whether in fact we really needed to do the hands-on change on somebody at all. I wasn't doubting it, I just needed to know how far it went. And so I decided that since I was finishing the training and all of this had happened, I would just call it something else, and I would focus purely on working that way for a number of years and just see, well, you know, how far does it go? Does that fix everybody's problem? How many problems can you actually solve going at it that way? Or is there still some other things you need to work on that are basic, you know, long-term reinforced habits that are not gotten at by somebody becoming more aware of how they go about things in their life from their point of view? So the last kind of 10 years or so have been pretty much making that experiment. And I must say at this point, it certainly went a lot further than I thought it would, and it's using the kind of two aspects together, that is, going into that kind of what I would call the learning methods territory with people does solve an awful lot of things an awful lot quicker, but then there's still the territories where there are the physical issues that people have when they're simply operating in ways that were not designed to operate in the physical world. You know, they aren't aware of where support is, and they're trying to do things physically that their body doesn't work that way, or they have complete misconceptions about the way that they're built, and they're trying to run the misconception, not the actual body they have. And so I also began to develop the what I call the anatomy of wholeness work, which is a way of helping people learn more about how they actually function from the kind of whole person point of view. I'll stop a bit and let you ask more questions. Yeah.
I know it's such an area of fascination that it's too easy for me to just want to keep asking you questions about that anyway, David, but I do feel indebted to all the people that have signed up to listen and participate today who have come under the pretense that we're going to be talking about Alexander Technique in the 21st century. And some of the questions that I have are more or less related quite strongly to the evolution of the work, if it can evolve, if it needs to, if we can continue working on a one-to-one basis and ever expect more than just a handful of people to know about the Alexander Technique. My mission, as I was explaining to a colleague yesterday, is that everybody would have the opportunity to hear about or experience the Alexander Technique or the principles of at least once in their life. And at the rate we're going, I'm wondering if that will ever be possible unless we change our way of reaching people. So what
yes,
are your
I'm
thoughts
sure it won't be.
On that?
Sorry? Well, you know, there's something that has come up a lot recently with this recent British Medical Journal study, at least published in the British Medical Journal, and I hear a lot of enthusiasm from people saying this is really going to change things. But, you know, I don't think it actually will very much. First of all, it's not all that dramatic a study. It's one of the first ones that's been a randomized controlled study, but it's, it's kind of comparing it to massage. And I think there will be some things happen with it. But I think one of the sort of challenges of things is for people not to expect that they can kind of carry on teaching the way that they have and that suddenly the work will catch on. In other words, that everybody else out there is going to suddenly get the technique and the technique sort of stays the way it is. I don't think that's going to happen. I think it's us that has to change. and not just us that has to change the way we try and market the technique, but actually the way we're doing the technique. And in a sense, I think that's where we need to kind of get away from trying to work out what did Alexander do and how can we do the same thing, and in a sense do what Alexander did, as I was saying in the beginning, and really look closely at those people that come into us, you know, what is going on with them? What is actually the problem there? Because if we just see them through our Alexander eyes, then they come in and the first thing we want to do is introduce them to all of Alexander's ideas, and in a sense we want to drag them away from their life and their point of view and what they're doing and teach them a whole bunch of new things they weren't doing before. And the biggest single change for me in a way in the work has been in a sense to not bring in anything new to somebody, but to look at them and they come in with their problem or their issue and say, okay, so you know, why is this happening? What's going on with this person that this is happening for them? And in that sense, of course, it completely changes the role around. So then, normally speaking, the Alexander teacher is the expert who knows all the Alexander stuff and is going to get that across to the student so that the student learns to think kind of the way that the teacher is thinking. But from this point of view, we're really saying, I'm not the expert. I don't know what's going on at all with this person. They're the expert. They're the one that has all the information about what's happening. They know when their symptoms are are going on. They know what they're up to at that moment. They know what the situation is. They know the way they're thinking. They know the way they're reacting. And we don't know any of that because they have all the information. What we might know and what we certainly could know if we were looking at it that way is we could also realize they have all the information, but they probably are not very conscious of it in the sense that they've looked at it very systematically. They're experiencing it all. They are having the thoughts, but they may not be able to say, oh, you know, I'm thinking this when this happens. And I'm not thinking that at another time when that other thing happens. And then I start to react. I get close to the edge of the cliff and I start to react and I feel a bit afraid. And then I think, oh my God, it's that fear of heights. And then I react more. And, you know, they have all the information about things, but they haven't actually, they have no tools to sit down and really look through it very systematically and rigorously. And so they don't know what to do with it all. And the possibility for us, if we kind of went at it that other way and go, they've got all the information, we could help them get all that information out on the table and help them make sense out of it and help them learn how they function. And in that sense, we're more like guides. In a certain sense, put it the other way around, is my approach has changed so much now that I'm not really very interested in giving somebody a new experience, you know, particularly one of those really nice ones. I'm much, much more interested in helping them understand the experiences that they're having every day out there in the real world, most of which they completely misunderstand.
Oh, terrific. So in some, what I'm hearing is you're talking about a way that I see a lot of Alexander Technique teachers work with groups or with actors. It's not so much the traditional model of explaining primary control or explaining, you know, putting your hands on an actor and saying, this is how you, if you move this way, everything will open up for you. Mm-hmm. There's more of an inquiry process going on in the moment and in relation to exactly what they're wanting to do.
Yes. We're, in a sense, helping them learn how to think for themselves and understand that, learning how to navigate their own experiences and I suppose you could say learning how they work, how they function. You know, I'll go back to it a little bit too, because I think there's another thing, even while we're staying within some of the Alexander principles, that I've seen a lot, and this came really from probably one of the main influences I've had on me, a man who wasn't even an Alexander teacher at all, but he's far and away the person I've learned the most about teaching and learning from, and that's someone named Bob Abramson, who's a Dow Crowes Eurythmics teacher in New York City. And he turned me on to a book by Mortimer Adler, and one of the things Adler was saying about the sort of order of learning has to mirror the order of discovery, that, you know, we all learn things. Alexander didn't just go, oh, let's see, I'll figure this out, so there must be innovation and direction. And, you know, you read that book, and he had his problem, he began his investigation, and he had a first insight. And out of that first insight, that opened up a bit of territory that he could explore, and out of that could then discover the next bit of something, which he then explored, and that unfolded and discovered the next bit of something, and so on it went. So that there's an actual order to the discoveries that someone makes. You start with step one, and only because of step one is it possible to even see or understand step two, and so on and so on. So pedagogically speaking, when we teach people, you know, we can't go into it and go, well, here's the five or six principles of the Alexander Technique, blah, 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 blah. We kind of need to go, now, what is it that somebody can, from where they are right now, what is it that somebody can grasp from where they are that will give them the first little step? And then after they've played with that or understood that, what's the next thing that can happen? And so in a sense, the job of the teacher is kind of a diagnosis. You know, where is this student? What do they know right now and what don't they know? Where are they in their learning? And if they're at this particular point, what is the thing that they are actually able to learn? And how can I scaffold a set of experiences or demonstrations or something that, in a sense, is set up so that they have a very good chance of of understanding or making sense out of it, rather than me giving them an experience, often, which is a huge experience, way beyond their ability to make sense out of it. And of course, the average student just goes, "Whoa, that's lovely, I want that." And we go, "No, you're not supposed to try and recreate it." But it's like giving somebody a lollipop and then saying, "But don't want another one, okay?" Whereas if we kind of, by the time we've seen them move or we see them talk, we go, "Okay, I see where this person is. They're not understanding this. Now, how can I set up a set of movements or a series of something that they, if they go through it, they will have some insights, and I'm not even going to tell them. I'm going to see, now, what did you get from that? And if I set it up well, they have a very strong likelihood of making some connections and learning something. And so, I think there's a big change even on that level to kind of look at, well, what is this work? How did I learn it as I went through my training? How was it presented to me? Because often it was presented as a whole thing. But what were the actual steps that I made in learning, and what are the steps that people can make one by one by one?
David, what I'm going to have to do is, believe it or not, we are 45 minutes into our call.
Wow.
I'm just going to have to mute somebody's line who's just called in, a late caller, or maybe someone who dropped out and called back. Let me just mute that line because it's feeding back into my ears. David, because we've gone and talked so voraciously about all of these things, what I'm going to have to do now is open the call for people to ask questions.
Yeah, good.
That's okay with you. Well, I do like to try and keep these to an hour, and I think probably what we'll have to do is book another chat at another time. But if anyone now does have a question they'd like to ask David, please press 5-star on your phone. And then what that will do is it will indicate to me on my screen that you've got a question, and then I can unmute your line and let you ask a question. Okay, we have our first question, David. Let me just unmute your line. And hello, go ahead. Oops. Yes. Can you hear me? Okay, go ahead.
There I am. Okay.
There you are, Frannis. I thought it might have been
Frannis.
Go ahead.
Frannis from Hawaii. I've already thought about my question.
Hi, Frannis.
My question is, hey, David. My question is, I'm very concerned that Alexander Technique is going to be known as Sit-Up Straight School. And I would really like not have this happen. To not have a technique so short. And I came up with the idea that perhaps we should, or we could, section the Alexander Technique off into the remedial, the performance mastery, the consciousness and self-image, and the education of training flexible routines and how to undo what you learn by accident, as sort of the four various specialties of Alexander Technique. And so we're presenting it not as just one big thing that's supposed to be this panacea of snake oil, good for whatever ails you, but actually section it off into specialties, areas of specialty. You have any other ideas about how Alexander Technique might be presented to you in the future that would help it not be sold short?
Well, I think I understand your question. It's sort of an interesting idea, but in a way I think it's already what's happening is there are teachers who have certain specialties. They've come from a performance background and they end up working with performers, or they you know, they work with a particular niche of movement activity, and some work mostly or only with remedial work, perhaps in a hospital or a clinic. So it's kind of being self-chosen, I think, in any case. Probably, I can't see any advantage, I don't think, in it being imposed in any way. I can't even see how it would, and probably we'd all get into fights about what the categories should be, simply because everybody would have their own their own take on it, and you know, where it's a continuum, not a sort of segmented thing. But if you were talking about, you know, what any one specific teacher could do, I think it makes a great deal of sense for people to look at, you know, what do I have myself that is either where my knowledge all came from, what was my background before, and where can I bring my particular personal knowledge or my interest and my curiosity into this work to work with people in that niche. Would probably be much, much more effective for anybody wanting to start a practice to specialize in that way than to go, I'm just open for everybody, because you just can't reach everybody, and you don't get word of mouth that way. It's all dissipated. I'm not particularly concerned about the technique sort of becoming, as you wrote in your thing, in danger of being known as the sit-up straight school, because I think that would only happen in a certain niche anyway, and it would probably be good if, you know, at least it became popular in that niche, if not in others. You know, and even if it did become popular that way, in a way that competed with where other places people go for back problems, which would be probably much, you know, a great thing and much more effective than a lot of the things they do, there would still be lots of teachers going in other areas anyway.
Okay, how'd you go with that?
So how could Alexander Technique be, you know, better branded or associated with, you know, itself? Because everybody always asks, what is the Alexander Technique like, you know?
Well, yeah, this is an odd one, though. I think it's a tendency we have to sort of speak of it as if it's an it, you know, Alexander Technique, but it exists
right
in each person's conception of it. So it's really more how can any one person brand it, you know, in their own way, because it's one of the odd things about that work, and for that matter, the learning methods aspects of it that I'm doing, is it's applicable to almost any issue, and with the learning methods, literally any issue, including, you know, relationships and phobias and anything. So it's so broad that you can't really approach it, but inevitably, I think people, any one individual goes, how do I want to market? How do I see it? And how do I want to market it to get at the people that I want to get at and that I feel I have something to offer?
Good answer.
All right, thanks, Fran. Thank you. And
I don't
have any people at this stage with a live request to ask questions. If you do want to ask a question, just press 5 and star on your telephone keypad. So without further ado, why don't we move on, David, to some of the written questions that have come in, because they've been crackers. I've sent them to you. How about if you pick which one you want to go for first, perhaps if you could read out the text of that question.
As I said to you in the beginning, I'd love to get into the question that Joe Boland asked, but in terms of our time, I would like to give it a lot more time, because I think it opens up a huge thing about, you know, the question was basically, if you had a chance to speak with F.M. Alexander, what questions would be foremost in your mind, and what do you believe would be
Alexander's
reaction?
Oh, I love that too,
Alexander's
but that
reaction.
Really isn't on topic either, is it? So it was, if I may,
so. Maybe we could leave that one for another time, if there might be another time, because it opens up a big one. Otherwise, I'd maybe just go for the simple first one is, do you have any suggestions for jump-starting a new practice in an area lacking
right
Alexander teachers?
Right.
And I do, and I think in one way it's actually a bonus, because you can go into a new area and really go at it any way you want. you're not kind of stuck having to deal with how someone else has done it before you. On the other hand, of course, the downside is you may not have colleagues to join together with, and someone else may not have done a lot of the groundwork for you, but it represents a potential really great opportunity. I always kind of look at it as the, you know, if we look around and we go, there are certainly no shortage of potential students with problems, the kind of problems or issues that we can solve and the kind of things we can offer people. So they're out there for sure. They just don't know we're here and they don't know what we've got. So it's a question of going, how do I get that out there in a way that they can connect with it? And I think these days there's just so many things that weren't there 20, 30 years ago. The first thing is obviously a website and to be able to get your stuff up there and potentially put recordings you may have made or videos on YouTube or things like that where people can find them and find you. It's a relatively easy way to connect with massive numbers of people. Plus the fact that once you write something or you get something out there, you get to be seen as an expert, you know, as somebody that knows something, even if you don't know any more than anybody else who hasn't written anything. So I'd suggest things like that, even if it's just writing something about your own personal experiences and how much the work affected you. In fact, that's one of the most effective ways of connecting with other people who, after all, are just like us. Other thing I think can be very helpful, especially in a new area, is to find one of the press release services where for a relatively small amount of money you can write a press release and have it sent out to all the media, you know, print media, radio media, television media. It often doesn't cost more than a couple hundred dollars to send it out to 300 or 400 to the very people who would then go, oh, this is kind of interesting. So-and-so's just moved into this area. Nobody's been here before with this work. And let's put an article in our local newspaper or do an interview on television. Or, you know, because we often, at least I used to think before I started to do some things that, oh, that's kind of, you know, they won't want to talk to me, but, you know, they're hungry for material. And if there's any angle that you can put in there, and even one or two people respond and you get into a newspaper or on a radio show, bingo, there's, you know, thousands of people hearing what you're doing. I don't know how long...
That's a jump start. It's a big jump start.
Yeah.
That free publicity. Okay, that's terrific. So after all of your years, David, they would be the first things that you would do. If you went to it, if you started in a new area, they are the number one things to do first. And once you've done them, then maybe what we can do is get an update and put that onto our website. Okay, you've done these things, now what? Because there's dozens and dozens of things that we can do to publicize ourselves. But you graduate with a teacher's degree or qualification in the Alexander Technique, it certainly is not a marketing qualification.
Yeah, that's true. And a lot of trainings, unfortunately, do almost nothing to even help people learn how to really get out there and teach, let alone build a practice.
Yes, so that's what Direction Journal is intended to be for these, for our subscribers, is a vehicle for learning more about how to better communicate with the general public, and you can always get better at that.
Yeah.
So, David, is there any other question there that we could do in about 5 minutes, do you think? Is there something that you could...
I'm just looking. We have one other question that came in from Rafaela. What are the one of the part is how could you say what can working on oneself become interesting for business people?
How can working on oneself become interesting for business people? Yeah.
Well, there's a bit of a question here about how can in the workplace how can this be done in groups and. You know, I think here's where that big change from I've got this technique stuff here and I somehow have to get it across to people is such a tough thing to sell, because until people have had the work, they don't know what it means, and you're trying to in a sense, get them to come to something in you. And I think if we look at it the other way and go, what's going on for them? What problems do they have? And, you know, rather than me try to go out and sell the technique to them, find out, well, what are they running into and how could I help them meet that? So, you know, until you, in a sense, you know what people, what the problems are that people have in the business place, how can you help them? We all know people that are business people, so, you know, a little bit of asking will quickly find what are the sort of problems, but not just in a sense, well, then how do I get them, still drag them back to my, you know, my technique thing where I'm asking them to look at the stuff I do, but go, so if they're doing that and they're, let's say, they're stressed by having all this extra amount of work, what practical things could I show them where they could maybe not get so sucked into that? Because, you know, in my experience, for instance, if so many people are coming, let's say the ones especially that are over busy, and it's one of the biggest problems these days in the modern world, they're actually coming, a lot of them, to us to learn ways to get rid of their problems so that they can be even busier without the problems.
Exactly.
And, you know, if you get sucked into that one, of course, it's a fool's game. You'll never get anywhere. We need to be quite clear that they've got a fundamental misconception about how they work, and their idea is it will actually be good. The more busy they are, the better it is. And it simply isn't true. And oddly enough, you know, they're finding it every day it isn't true. The busier they get, the worse it gets. It's up to us to help them find out, if you just slowed down and you did everything just at the speed you could do it, you were able to be in the present moment, do what you can do without getting sucked in, and meet those moments in the computer without narrowing into it, or meet the moments when it feels like there's pressure and still work away, just at what you can do, at the speed you can do, that would be a huge one. And not only huge in the physical state they find themselves in, but the sort of philosophical, mental, dare I say, almost spiritual place of the profound nature of what it means to come back into the present moment for people is just such a big one. And what everybody will find, but nobody will really, almost nobody will appreciate before they have a chance to experience it, is they will actually get more work done by not trying to get more work done. But, you know, they won't believe that until we can manage to in a sense, encourage them to make the experiment. And that you can do individually, that you can do in groups with a whole bunch of people in an organization. But it's all predicated on finding out, as it were, first from the student's point of view, you know, what's actually happening for them that's causing them this problem. And my experience has been, you know, the more I've kind of stepped in that direction rather than refine my ways of trying to get them to understand these sort of principles, if you like. The principles are all there and doing it the other way. It's just I'm coming out and kind of doing it through their eyes rather than getting them to try and see through my eyes.
Yes. And David, I think what you're talking about is exactly what Michael Gale talks about in the conversation we had with him several weeks ago, is that in a sense Michael Gale is a problem solver, and when the CEO calls him in, he sits down and he asks the questions about, so what's going on, what's going well, what's not. And then when the CEO or the whoever they are, they're dealing with, says, well, I've got this great big problem with creativity or people being too stressed and being overwhelmed, Michael pipes up and says, well, that's terrific. He'll say, I've got a program or a course for that, how to get people to be less stressed, less overwhelmed, and more creative in the workplace. Oh, really, Michael, you've got a program like that? Yes, I do. And he goes away and creates it. Mm. He asks them what their problems are, and then feeds back to them exactly what they're asking for based on, you know, his experience, his knowledge. But the principles of the Alexander Technique, of course, can be applied to all of those things. But as you say, David, you have to find out what they need first rather than going and selling the Alexander Technique as the solution to everybody's problems, which we know it can be.
Yeah. The big one is really finding out, you know, what is the problem from their point of view, and see, oh, yeah, of course, if you see it that way and that's the way you meet those moments, no wonder you're in that state. Now, how could you meet those moments in a different way? But it's all in their language and in their terms. And, you know, the other thing that I found is that people are much, much more interested in that because it's their life, it's their material, it's their words, it's their experience. It's not, gee, I'm learning this whole new language that I still don't know what it means, and it's very confusing. They go, oh, that's right.
How do I apply this theme? Yeah.
And, you know, everybody loves...
Well, that's a terrific... David, that is a really terrific place to where we should wind our call up. What I would like to invite from you, as I have done with one of our other guests a couple of weeks ago, Neat Andrews, she volunteered to start putting together a list of... She calls them etudes because she comes from a dancing background, Neat Andrews, and she works with movement etudes for people that are in movement classes, dancers, actors, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. She was quite happy to volunteer some of those course outlines or group outlines for other Alexander teachers to follow. And what I'd love to invite from you, David, is if you would be interested in giving some of those examples that maybe you would do with a group. As you've said, once you find out what their issues are, it's great to... It's quite straightforward to go and run groups for the workplace. But if I can put up some examples of, say they've asked for this, say they've asked for that, would I be able to put the hard word on you to give us some examples of how you would work with them?
Well, I could. I don't have much time to do something new, but in a sense I've already done a lot of that. There's a lot of the articles about pieces of work up on the website, the learningmethods.com website. There's also one of the things that I've been working on a lot in the next whole series of workshops I'm doing in Ireland and the UK and in Toronto and Montreal and, you know, probably in other places, is a lot of exactly this territory, especially for teachers. One thing I'm just working on now, or I've been developing over quite a while, but I'm putting it out there now, is what I call standing on top of the world. It's the whole territory about balance and support and how few people really are in touch with what's going on in their movements when they sit and stand and walk and go upstairs. And even when I do for a group of Alexander teachers, and I find, you know, half of them are quite unaware of the ways that they are in relation to the to their support, even though they might be trying to be as free within them, they really don't understand a lot of the principles about how we function that way. So I've developed a whole workshop over a weekend that goes through this in a very, very step-by-step way, that the goal is to get people understanding how we function and not only understanding it, but in touch with it. But even more, the goal for teachers is, you know, here's a very simple and very clear set of things that you can learn to use with your own students, and especially in a group or individually, that can get people in touch with things and get them moving differently very, very quickly. You know, in 15 or 20 minutes, you can get somebody able to sit and stand and move in and out of a chair in a totally different way because they really understand what's going on. And there is no head pulling back, but nobody's had to inhibit anything because they're simply not setting up all those balance reactions. So, in other words, to make a long story short, there is a number of recordings and other things already on the website and workshops around, and some of those I will be probably at some point either doing as a video or as a workbook. So it may be possible to extract some bits of that for direction as I go along.
Okay, that's fine. Well, so long as people have a way to get access to those sorts of things, if they can't get to your workshops, they can come to your website, which is learningmethods.com. You have a number of downloadable things that people can
There's downloadable e-books. There's going to be more in recordings. If you're interested in being kept up with things, you can sign up onto the mailing list at the website, and we'll let you know about new publications. And I especially want to develop, you kind of spurred me on a little bit about this, Paul, to get more little short audio clips of downloadable clips and other things that can give little pieces of quite usable things and get that out there.
Good. All right, David. Well, look, it's been an absolute pleasure spending some time with you today. If anybody has questions other than the ones that have been asked today and we didn't get around to them, I know we're going to have to run another call with you, David, because the material that we can cover is plentiful. But thanks, everyone, for being on the call today. Thank you, David, very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you. Pleasure.
And the recording from this call, I will tidy up a little bit, cut out all my ums and ahs, and I'll have that up onto the website very soon at directionjournal.com. So what I'm going to do now is just unmute all the lines so that you can say a quick thank you to David for his time. And once you've had the opportunity to do that, we'll end the call and call it quits. And David, if I can please just have you stay on the call at the end so that we can have a quick chat before before we hang up. That'd be great. Thanks. I think I'm able to here we go. A few of those lines are unmuted now. You should be able to hear your line say, no longer muted. Yay!
Thank you.
I have to mute mine.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Need 2 more hours, Paul.